Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Benson Close in Hounslow, TW3. 3 miles south of the last sighting of Alice Gross. 2 miles north of the Thames Towpath Killer. 1 mile south of the Chohan family murders. And just a few streets from the wannabe gangster's last words. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Benson Close is a cul-de-sac comprising of red brick apartments and an 11-storey high-rise block of flats which looms large over the street. As council homes built with a whack it up, make it cheap and cram them in mentality, the only sense of community is the nearby chip shop, which serves what every racist would dub the best of British cuisine. Like shish kebabs, pizzas, kung po chicken, curry sauce of an indeterminate origin, mushy peas so gooey you could use it as cement, and whelks. Ugh. For scores of families, this is home. But for decades, many have complained that it was used as a dumping ground for a local psychiatric unit and Feltham Young Offenders Institute. The same was true in 1993, when a young boy, said to have been born of pure evil, came to Benson Close. And with everything within walking distance of his flat, Milton Wheeler planned his spree of torture, rape, and murder. But was he evil from birth, a product of a bad upbringing, or merely a copy of his cruel father? My name is Michael, I'm your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 251, Like Father, Like Son. Milton's mother Doreen would state, I knew he was no angel, but when I found out what he had done, I couldn't believe it. I'm not condoning what Milton did. They're saying he is a psychopath, and he probably is, just like his dad. But who was the real Milton Wheeler? A loving son, or a psychopath? 2 years before Milton was even conceived, his father was already a career criminal, whose selfish crimes were frequently tinged with a sadistic streak and a frightening lack of empathy for his victims. In March 1969, in the town of Accrington, Lancashire, in the northwest of England, 21-year-old Russell Gainford, Milton's father, was found with a friend, 17-year-old Stephen Paul Daly, huddled together behind an outhouse at the yard of a home in possession of articles for use in connection with theft. Pleading guilty at Accrington Magistrates Court, Gainford admitted, I knew the house because I'd broken into it before. We were going to break in and get some stuff that I knew was there, such as the furniture, irreplaceable jewellery, family heirlooms, personal essentials, and even the coins from inside the gas meter. Collared by PCs Bromelow and Adelie, the two selfish hoodlums didn't care that this was the home of an elderly widow who, being fast asleep, they could have frightened to death, or even worse. As Gainford already had three prior convictions, with one being for the indecent assault on an elderly woman. Russell Gainford was a thief, a burglar, and a sexual predator, who would soon graduate to murder. By 1969, the year of his burglary conviction in Accrington, for which he would serve just 3 months, Russell had recently married Doreen. His first son, Ian, was only 3 months old. And on the 13th of February 1971, at Ruffley Maternity Home in Accrington, their second son, Milton Duncan Gainford, was born. Raised in Oswaldwrizzle, a sweet little town in the Hinburn Borough of Lancashire, having attended Green Haworth and Hillingsville primary schools, he should have had a decent but unremarkable upbringing amongst the rolling hills and the swooping dales. But how can a boy grow up normal when the one male role model in his life was a criminal, a sadist, a violent brute, and some said, a psychopath? In 1977, when Milton was just six, his father worked as a coalman, delivering logs, kindling and bags of coal across Oswaldwrizzle, Bedlam and Accrington. It was a responsible job for a responsible husband and father. But being a habitual thief, he used his route to scupper the homes of the most vulnerable. One such home was a little bungalow on Morehouse Avenue, where 78-year-old widow Gladys Bryant lived alone, being no bother to anyone. Like many working-class pensioners, she didn't have much beyond her tiny pension and possibly her late husband's watch. But all of these items, Russell coveted. Little is known about what happened, whether it was a failed burglary or a grudge attack. But in what was described as an apparently motiveless killing, he slit her throat and then stabbed her to death. Russell Gainford was sentenced to life in prison. With the family split, it wasn't long afterwards that Milton and his brother were taken into care. And with Milton said to be a product of violence and degradation who hasn't met decency in his life, this conviction had a profound effect on both boys. Like Milton, his older brother Ian had taken the brunt of the abuse from his violent, controlling father. And although deep down he despised him, either through a bad moral upbringing, learned behaviour, a willful decision or a genetic mistake, Ian had become a carbon copy of the man he hated so much. Educated in an all-boy detention centre, and unable to communicate with women, with warnings that he was at risk emotionally and socially, even Mr. Gosen, his defence lawyer, would state, "It seems that all of the predictions have come to fruition." Aged just 17, Ian was tried at Burnley Crown Court of stealing a girdle, a brassiere, and the indecent assault of females. He already had 15 similar counts, including public exposure to his name. And 9 years later, he was also sentenced to 10 years for rape. Ian was emotionally disturbed and uncontrollable. A sexual predator who lacked empathy for other humans. And although he had returned to live with his broken family, he found even that difficult. And not just because, like his father, he had regularly sexually abused his younger brother, Milton. Doreen, Milton's mother, said his father was a big influence on him. Even after he went to jail, he would write to Milton. It upset him greatly. Whether he did this as part of his controlling nature or to be deliberately cruel to his wife and son is uncertain. But he'd always get into trouble after hearing from his father. Every time his father contacted him, it brought out the worst in him. Even to this day, we don't know what made him flip. We think he may have heard from his father a few days before. Which again begs the question, if he despised his father so much, why are there so many similarities between Russell's crimes and Milton's? On the 3rd of June 1988, age 17, Milton Duncan Gainford of Albert Street in Oswaldwrestle was tried at Burnley Crown Court, charged with burglary and intent to commit wounding, GBH and rape. Like a coward, his victim was a young woman living alone in her own home, which he had broken into. Seized from behind, he thrust an 8-inch knife to her throat. And with his strange sexual desires taking hold, he ordered her to get into a swimsuit because he wanted her body. Fearing for her life, she put up a fight. And although he plunged the knife into her thigh and then throttled her with a pajama cord until she partially blacked out, as he tried to tie her up, she continued to fend him off. Meeting further resistance, as she attacked back, they rolled around on the floor as he tried to fondle her breasts and unzip her jeans, until finally he gave up exhausted. But it wasn't the terror he had inflicted, or the fact that he had strangled her, burned her, and tried to rape her, which had caused him the most consternation. But having drawn blood, he wanted the bleeding to stop, and he let her go to hospital. Stephen Hesford, his defence lawyer, stated, "Gainford was an inadequate person who had never had a girlfriend and saw the entry into the victim's home as a way of getting experience." Sentenced to 4 years in prison for attempted rape, he was told to undergo psychiatric assessment and treatment. Doctors would state, "He showed signs of significant sexual sadism, coldness, and a callous detachment. A complete absence of sympathy, remorse, and empathy for his victims, and a desire to dominate those around him." Not unlike his father. And although he attended some psychological rehabilitation, after his release from prison, he defaulted from treatment. By this time, the damage had been done, and he was living amongst the community. 2 years after Russell's incarceration, keen to make a better life for herself and her boys, Doreen remarried. Given Milton a more stable family life, with three half-brothers and sisters who think the world of him and worship the ground he walks on, and a positive male role model in his stepfather, Paul, Milton took his surname of Wheeler, and he seemed to change and become more responsible. He was a good kid. As his stepfather would state, "I would have stood by him through thick and thin." Milton was on the first steps of a long road to recovery, as having been unable to receive a letter from his convict father owing to prison regulations, many said that he had improved, at least for a while. In 1993, 23-year-old Milton Wheeler moved 200 miles south to the small first-floor flat at 15 Cromwell Road in Hounslow. Being a stranger, with no known past, and a sickly pale boy with dark neck-length hair, sticking out ears, and a slightly horse-like face, he didn't look like a danger to the community. But with an uninterrupted view of Cromwell Road and Benson Close, and with everything being within a very short walking distance from his flat, this had become the new hunting ground for Milton Wheeler. His criminal spree began almost immediately. Being convicted on several occasions of stealing a set of tools, a handbag, a jacket, and a jumper worth £1,000, as well as damaging a Ford Granada and driving a Peugeot without insurance, all of which were, initially, small and annoying crimes. Pretty Shah, who ran the local grocery store, said, "Wheeler was a monster who blighted the community. Old people were scared to come out, to use the lifts, or to walk down alleyways." Situated at the bend of Benson Close, and visible from his bedroom, stood an 11-storey high-rise block containing 55 one- and two-bedroomed council flats. It was seen as a safe place, but with his pal on the third floor, giving Milton the access code to the security door, the danger was now within their walls. Just like his father's motiveless killing of a 78-year-old widow, it began innocently enough. When in April 1994, from outside of flat 80 on the third floor, he stole a bottle of milk worth 36p. The residents of flat 80 were Mr. and Mrs. Ambassador. Described as a quiet and gentle couple who kept to themselves, they had originally come from India in 1978 to raise their three daughters. As devoted Hindus, they spent many hours a day in private prayer, and like Gladys Bryant, they were no bother to anyone. When they moved to Benson Close, they saw their home as a safe place, which became essential, especially as they got older and frailer. With Madhavji being aged 82 and his wife Rally at age 72, both suffered from heart and kidney problems, and with Rally becoming less mobile owing to her arthritis, both being infirm, they proved to be easy targets. In December 1993, just 4 months before, an unidentified burglar who had access to the building having used the key codes broke into their flat, tied up this terrified old couple, and although nothing was taken, no one was ever arrested. But there was a suspicion about who it may have been. Monday the 11th of April 1994 was the day of Milton's spree of torture, rape and murder. Milton had finished his shift as a packer at a local freight company. With no real hobbies, except being a menace, still wearing his overalls, and with a Stanley knife and a set of scissors in his pocket, he headed to the pub. Being drunk, his mood was bad. And still seething, he later confided to a cellmate, "I wanted to wreak revenge on the old cow for having dared to suggest that I had stolen some milk," which he probably had. The flat at the bend of Benson Road took him past several people who he knew, but he didn't care. The security door was no bother. He just inputted the code and let himself in. And climbing the stairs, nobody batted an eyelid, as he was often seen on the third floor. Only this time, he wasn't going to call for his pal, but for someone he wanted to punish. It was roughly 7 p.m. Relliot of flat 80 unlocked the door as anyone else would, believing she was safe and that the only people with access to the building were family, neighbours or friends. Only he was neither. The second the door opened, Milton burst in, his Stanley knife in one hand and scissors in the other, as he repeatedly stabbed the frail elderly lady about the face and the neck. Hearing his screams, although slow and doddery himself, Manavchi tried to protect his wife, but was stabbed in the face, neck, chest and stomach. As the married couple both slumped onto the living room floor in twin pools of blood. None of the neighbours heard a thing. Or maybe they'd mistaken it for something else, so nobody came to their aid. Only Milton's revenge on this couple over a milk bottle was far from finished. As with the cord of her dressing gown, twice he strangled the life out of her, maybe out of spite. And with his Stanley knife, he severed her throat with such force that the blade went down to the bone. Mr. and Mrs. Ambassador were dead. And although he had taken their lives, he would also humiliate them in death, as these proud religious devotees were stripped and humiliated in ways too graphic for the press to publish. And then, having stolen some jewellery, a few knick-knacks, and a little cash, he left. He closed the door. He descended the stairs. He exited the building, and then calmly walked down Benson Close with their blood still on his hands. A vulnerable couple lay dead and defiled. But just as his father had, still being high after the killing, Milton was hungry. At roughly 8:30 p.m, Milton walked down to the Silver Fish Bar at 35 Cromwell Road, barely 1 minute from the murder, and used his victim's meagre pension money for a slab of meal for himself. Around the chip shop, several teens on bikes had congregated, as they do, making noise and causing a nuisance. Especially to two local girls, aged just 14 and 18, who were sheltering from a gang of boys. Being a few years older than these scared girls, with Milton being a stranger, but someone they felt that they could trust, as he left carrying his food, they asked if they could walk with him. It's uncertain what happened next, but having been invited back to his friend's flat, maybe for chips, behind the security door with the access code, this was a safe place for the girls, away from the gang of boys, but not from him. Climbing the stairs, they had no inkling to the horrors which awaited them. Upon the third floor, they had no hint what atrocities this man had unleashed in flat 80. But as he opened the door to his friend's flat and let the two girls in, locking the door behind him, he uttered a sentence so chilling and cold.
"I'm going to make you wish you'd never come in here."
Pulling out his Stanley knife and scissors, which were still stained with the blood of the last two people who had crossed him, holding the blades to their throats, Milton ordered the terrified girls to strip naked. any refusal led to them being beaten across the face, and any sounds were punished in a similar way. Across the next 2 hours, holding both of these trembling girls at knife point, he sexually assaulted his hostages and raped the youngest. The torture went on and on. And although he had violated them, the biggest fear wasn't the pain, but never knowing if, how and when his sadistic torture would end. Only having left them bruised, petrified and crying, Milton was far from finished. Silencing them with the threat of being stabbed, he marched the two naked girls from his flat, across the corridor, and into flat 80, where the bloodied and mutilated bodies of Mr. and Mrs. Ambassador still lay. Sprawled out like trophies of this psychopath's frenzy, and a further warning for the girls to be silent. Dragging the girls into the bedroom, he tied each girl to a separate bed, where they were both sexually assaulted repeatedly at knife point, and given the ultimatum to decide
which one of you is going to die.
After a further hour of torture, having left both girls naked, gagged, and tied spread eagle to the beds, he bit the girls so hard that he left teeth marks, and as before, he left without a care in the world. There was no denying that Milton was a sadist and a psychopath. And although he hated his father, their crimes were eerily similar. They both attacked the elderly. They both slashed and strangled their victims. They both used weapons which they carried for their jobs. Neither could offer an explanation for the violence, with Milton saying,
"I can't remember anything,"
and his father stating,
"Why I did it, I don't know."
And they both ate immediately after they had killed. As having been arrested, Richard chillingly said,
"I threw away the knife and went home and had my tea."
But it was while Milton was in his flat at 15 Cromwell Road, overlooking Benson Street, that he missed the most vital detail of his killing spree. That the youngest girl had escaped. Having wriggled free from her binds, she'd alerted the caretaker, and by 11 p.m. the whole street was swarming with police. As his father had, Milton stood watching as the block of flats was sealed off. Initially, the police were at a loss, stating,
"It's a bizarre case, because we can't find any connection between the white girls and the Asian couple. It's a mystery."
With the only link being that the victims were found in the same flat. With the girls being cared for and questioned by specially trained officers, slowly they began to paint a picture of the incident, the culprit, what he looked like, as well as where they had met him. As you might expect, his arrest came swiftly, having committed a double abduction, a double rape and a double murder, barely 300 feet from his home and in an area where he was known. And with his fingerprints found at the scene, his tooth marks on their bodies, their personal possessions in his pockets, and the bloodied knife still inside of his jacket, Milton and his pal whose flat it was they were held hostage in were arrested. More than 200 mourners attended the funeral of Mr. and Mrs. Ambassador in Hanworth, with them both described
as a lovely, quiet couple who were totally devoted to one another.
In court, the constable who chaperoned the two girls said they found the strength to get over this horrendous ordeal, but there is part of their youth that has gone, and I don't think it will ever come back. Tried at the Old Bailey on the 20th of February 1995, 24-year-old Milton Duncan Wheeler faced 10 charges, including abduction, rape, buggery, indecent assault, and murder. With three psychiatrists agreeing that he was suffering from a severe long-standing psychopathic disorder and that he presented a grave danger to the public, the judge accepted his plea of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Oddly, though, he pleaded guilty to the charges of rape, indecent assault, and false imprisonment. But he denied the further charges of sexual assault and four further charges of indecent assault. With Judge Neil Dennison QC summing up,
"You are, in the view of the doctors, and I agree, an extremely dangerous young man, and you will remain so for a long time to come."
He was sentenced to 18 years for the murders, a further 14 years for the rapes, and mandatory treatment at Ashworth Psychiatric Hospital. As of today, Milton Wheeler is 53 years old, having spent two-thirds of his life in prison. Ironically, when Milton was convicted, his father, Richard Gainford, was released on license. Professor David Cantor, who pioneered criminal profiling, said of Milton,
"It is not a common pattern, but the fact that his father was a murderer and his brother was a rapist have significant bearings on his actions."
But was he born evil, a product of a bad upbringing? Or was he merely copying his cruel father?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Oh, jeez. I coughed so hard then I just farted. Hello, everyone. How are we all doing? Just taking your little hat off. Oh, Christ. I'm still not well. I'm getting through my bronchitis, though. I think I'm coming out the other end. I've only filled up a quarter of a bag of mucus-filled tissues today. So this won't be as horrific. I will be blowing my nose a lot. I will be coughing. But still bronchus, bronchitis-y. Oh, it's horrible. And there was some... I had to... Now it's a really tickly cough. It's really annoying. I just cough all the time. And then you wake up in the middle of the night and you have these massive coughing fits. To the point now that I need to go back into hospital next week to check that all this bronchitis hasn't ruptured my eye again. Oh, joy. It's almost a year since I got bronchitis. Last time. This is really getting really annoying now. Anyway, there we go. Welcome to Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit. We're going to have some hilarious chat with me grumbling about shit. We'll do some quiz questions and we'll do some bits that didn't make it into the episode, but mostly coughing, I think. Oh, hang on. I might have one of my little sweeties. I used to rave about my Jakemans all the time. Jakemans are really good. They're very soothing at night. But now they've got these the Cavonia cough drops. They're very good. They're not like Lemsips where you put them in and they don't do anything. It's like, oh, it's a little bit lemony for a bit. And then, you know, it disappears. These are very good. You put them in immediately and they're, you're like, oh, yeah, very good. Hopefully this will get me through this. Just before we started recording, some bastard on a mower was outside. One of those sit-on mowers. And I was like, why is he out again? He mowed yesterday and he mowed the day before. And he mowed the day before that, even though it was raining the day before that. Fucker seems to be mowing every day. And you just go, I've looked at your garden. Your garden's shit. Why are you still mowing it? It's like, give. Ooh, what have I got in my pocket? I think I've got an old sweet in my pocket. Don't know where that come from. Anyway, I'm not going to go and make myself a tea because I've still got a blackcurrant Lemsip. That has kind of helped me get through this. Oh, thank you to new Patreon supporters. Thank you to Mother Hen and Lorraine Drury. So thank you to Mother Hen. Thank you to Lorraine Drury. Thank you so much. Loads of goodies to enjoy on Patreon. I upload lots of exclusive content, lots of behind-the-scenes stuff, things that are interesting. So I hope you're enjoying those. Also, thank you to Barbara Johnson. Thank you for your very kind donation. I know it was your birthday and you donated to me. So that's incredibly kind of you. So I hope you had a good birthday. So thank you, Motherhead. Thank you, Lorraine. Thank you, Barbara. I keep meaning to check supporter links, do you know, where you can do a donation. I keep forgetting because Acast, they take the money, they take their cut, and then they just include it in kind of our monthly advertising monies. So I never see it come in. I have to physically go into the website, and then I have to find the subsection it's in, then I have to find the button, and it's a real pain in the arse. So anyone who does do a supporter, thank you so much. I don't reply immediately because I don't know it's come in and I keep forgetting to check. But if you do want to do a donation, you can do it through the Murder Mile website. There's a donate button and that's created by me. Acast doesn't take a cut of it. Comes straight through to me and I get alerted to it because I've set up an email system on it. And then I can reply to you via email and say thank you very much, which is a nice way to do it. So I'm going to check that next week or hopefully today. Let's do some quiz questions. Don't forget, I haven't edited the episode yet, so some of these I may balls up. I've only done 9 questions on this one. I know, crazy. Some of them I may balls up in this bit anyway, so let's give it a go. How tall is the high-rise block on Benson Close? Question 2, what was Milton's middle name? Question 3, Milton was born in what maternity home? Question 4, what town did he grow up in? You can have an attempt to pronounce that if you like. It's spelt differently as it's pronounced, and I've kind of pronounced it how it's near to how it's meant to be pronounced, but everyone has different pronunciations of it. Question number 5, what job did Milton's father do? Question number 6, age 17, Milton's brother Ian was convicted of what 3 offences? Question number 7, what was the name of Milton's stepfather? Question number 8, what happened to Mr. and Mrs. Ambassador 4 months before the murder? And question number 9, what job did Milton do? So there you go. Just having a look at the similarities between their attacks. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it, how he clearly... His mum says he's influenced by his dad, but he clearly doesn't like his dad because his dad abused him. And his dad was violent towards him. And there's possibly sexual abuse there as well. And yet, this is the kind of interesting thing, isn't it? With some people who have kind of, if you have trauma in your past, some people really run away from it and some people run towards it. And it makes it's kind of interesting how everyone's different, you know. You would think if someone was horrible and nasty to you, you would go out of your way to, like, if they were rude, you'd be polite. If they acted like, oh, Cockney geezer, you'd put on a posh accent, you know. If they were messy, you'd be neat. You'd rally against it. And if they were cruel to people, you'd be the politest person in the world. Whereas some people, they see these nasty people and they're almost like they're drawn towards them, almost like, you know, it's like a mentor figure. Or it could be that that's the person he was raised up with, and he doesn't see the difference between right and wrong, which is weird when you look at the fact that, you know, his mum seems like a decent person, and as she said, you know, she remarried quite early on as well, and he's got half brothers and sisters, and they seem to be doing well. So, you know, his stepfather seems to be good. So it's interesting that he has that choice. There he could go down the route with his stepmom and his stepdad and his half brothers and sisters and have a lovely life, or be stuck in this kind of rut of his, I'm gonna say it, his shitbag dad. If people are upset about that, his dad can take me to court and then he'll have to prove that he's not a shitbag, although the evidence is there. So the similarities between their attacks are really quite interesting. They both attacked elderly victims, are quite often very vulnerable victims. They both slashed the victim's throat and tried to strangle them. So there's a real power play going on here. They both used knives that they would have used in their jobs. So Milton used the Stanley knife and the scissors because of his job. I can't say what that is because obviously that's one of the quiz questions. Well done, Michael. And his father used a knife because he was a... I think that's one of the quiz questions as well, isn't it? Hang on. No, it's not. Oh, yeah, it is. Question 5. See, I'm getting good at this. They both enjoyed a meal after their attacks. So as we've seen in here, Milton went off and had fish and chips immediately after the murder. And his father said, I threw away the knife and went home and had my tea. Both returned to the scene after the bodies had been discovered. Milton said he found it was swarming with police, and his father later told detectives, I drove my wagon around and saw an ambulance outside of the house and I knew something was wrong. And neither of them could offer an explanation as for the violence. Milton said, I can't remember anything. His father said, I still don't know why I did it. I still don't know. So we don't really know a lot about their connection together, whether Milton and his father committed kind of minor offences earlier in their life together. And maybe that's how Milton learned how to do things. Because it seems weird that he would do similar things to his father, like the need for food immediately afterwards and, you know, watching as the crimes unfold. That doesn't seem something that would kind of naturally happen. That seems to be a learned behavior. Interesting, in around this time of the murder, it is said that in 15 Cromwell Road, which is where his flat was, this has been a really hard case to piece together. Obviously, the court records aren't there, so I've had to use all the press sources. And as you know, press sources aren't that reliable. They tend to make up a lot of bullshit whenever it suits them. And what seems to be happened with the two girls, he met them at the chip shop. And then what is said by some people is that he took them back to his flat, which is at 15 Cromwell Road, which is just a couple of doors down from there, and immediately looking over Benson Road. And there, the first sexual assault happened. But if that did happen there, then he had to walk them all the way down Benson Close to get to the flat, to Benson Close, where his mate was. Now, the reason that would have been is, even though throughout this case, a lot of people said, especially in court, they said his problem was he never had a girlfriend. His mum would deny. She said that he didn't struggle. In fact, he had a girlfriend in 15 Cromwell Road at that time, which is why he couldn't stay in that flat. So I've deliberately taken that bit of the story out, because for me, that's the bit that doesn't make sense, is him walking the girls into the flat, closing his door and saying, I'm going to make you wish you'd never come here, raping the girls there, then walking them 300 feet down the road in broad daylight, through the security door, a block of flats, up three flights of stairs, into his mate's flat, then raping them there, then taking them over to the other flat. Between the two flats in the block of flats, that makes sense, because it's kind of, they're close together. Walking them down a long street doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense at all. So I've taken that bit out, only because that's the bit that doesn't lack logic. When a lot of journalists tend to write this stuff up, they're under, you know, strict deadlines. Half the time they don't even double check the distances between places. They just went, he went here, he went there, he went there. They don't look at how far it is. Whereas me, I physically look at it to try and work out how long it would take, what it would be like, would you be seen, are there any cameras? For me, that's important. For journalists, quite often, they just don't give a shit. They just want to put crap on paper. Move on to the next article, the next piece of shite that they need to churn out. His first sex attack at knife point was in 1988, when he was age 17, for which he was given a 4-year sentence for attempted rape and was requested to attend a psychiatric assessment and treatment. This was the... See, it's odd, isn't it? A lot of these crimes are very similar to his father, isn't it? They all seem to be... A lot of them are based around a burglary or a home invasion. Part of it involves theft. Quite a lot of it is sexually motivated, but it's all quite sadistic sexual motivation. Do you know, there's something sinister in there. So, again, I don't think this... I think a lot of this is kind of learned behaviour from his father, but we don't really know how and why that kind of came from that. I got hiccups now. Hiccups, just bugger off. So 3rd of June 1988, he was committed for trial at Burnley Crown Court, charged with burglary and intent to commit rape and wounding with intent to cause GBH. I've pretty much used it. I'll be honest, I had to really go searching for... It was only when I went searching for his prior offences, because in the press, they didn't really mention much about it. So I had to go... Same with his father. I had to really dive into his past and work out where his father had been, work out his real name and, you know, have a look at these other crimes. And then that kind of led me down the track of, you know, the crimes that his brother had committed. It's kind of weird, isn't it, that you would think... With cases like this, you would think the press would be so keen to go, right, let's do a really thorough job on this and not just focus on the grisly details of the murder and the rape, but to dive into the past. But they just couldn't be bothered. They really couldn't be bothered. And it's not like I found these in hidden away in a box. This was on like news, not news websites, but I've got multiple news kind of source websites, like, you know... British newspapers and the newspaper archive and things like that, which are really useful, but, you know, quite often journalists just can't be arsed. At his psychiatric treatment, so he attended some of it when he was in prison, but that's only because it was mandatory in prison. Obviously, when he left prison, it was more kind of a voluntary thing, and he just couldn't be asked to turn up anymore. Or maybe he was one of these people who just thought, well, I don't need that. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm mentally fine. So, like the day well, I used to work in a petrol station years ago, and I had the world's shittest boss, and a leaflet turned up one day, and it said it was about being a good boss, and he scrunched it up in front of me and threw it in the bin. I went, well, I don't need that. I just thought, you arrogant little shit. He really was a shit. The doctor said I need psychiatric treatment. He shows a significant degree to sexual sadism, an extreme degree of coldness and callous detachment, a complete absence of sympathy, remorse and empathy for his victims, and a desire to dominate those around him. So that was in 1992, before the murders and before the abductions and the rapes. So, you know, I think there's a lot in his past that we don't know so far. There's a lot that's kind of hidden away that I'd love to dive into more, but this is one of those cases where you've just got to, there's nothing that we can get out of the archives. You know, this is far too soon. I think we'd probably be at least another 15-20 years away from this, and we probably only get the appeal papers on this anyway. So what else we got? The day of the murder, it looks like he'd some people say he'd taken a day off, but it seems kind of weird that he was wearing his work clothes, and in his pocket he'd got his Stanley knife and his scissors, which he used in his job. So it's supposed that he may have either worked the night shift and then gone to the pub, because it just doesn't make sense that he'd be wearing his work clothes and have his work tools with him on a day where he was taking the day off. I think, again, this is just a fact that journalists just don't like, oh, what was he doing that day? Oh, we don't know. Well, we'll just say he was taking the day off. Okay, bye. We know he was in a nearby pub, based on research. Nearest one seems to be the Lamplighter at 16 Staines Road, which was previously called the Oliver Cromwell, the Snug, Tommy Flynn's, the Wishing Well, the Friend in Hand. It's gone through many incarnations. And apparently he was drinking there for most of the day. Oh, good fun. I haven't had a drink in ages. I've been a good boy. Well done, Michael. Obviously, because he even drinks it all. He was drunk and apparently in a bad mood. We don't know how it really escalated from the supposed theft of a milk bottle worth 36p and him killing the couple, or making the decision to kill the couple. It seems a bit of a stretch. I'm personally of the opinion that he was the one who broke into their flat a year earlier. Sorry, that's one of the quiz questions. You can have that one for free. Fuck it, we need to discuss this anyway. It just seems, when you look at his past and you look at his father's past as well, his father was seen attempted to break into a building that he'd already broken into before, because there were things in there he wanted to get access to, and burglars do that. They don't, once they break into a place, because they've already got a lie of the land and they know how to get in, and also because they know that things that they've nicked will now be replaced, they tend to break back in. So I think it seems highly likely that of all the people who may have broken into that couple's flat, it's highly likely to be Milton, given the fact that his friend was on the same floor, the third floor, in a flat opposite. It just makes sense, doesn't it? So I think he probably was riled by the whole idea that she'd accused him of stealing a milk bottle, but I think there's a lot more in there, and especially the fact that, you know, he'd probably attempted to break into her flat before. Don't forget, he is a burglar. It's what he does. And he goes after vulnerable people. The attack... Oh, I'm going to blow my nose, sorry. Oh, joy. Well, at least it's not as mucousy as it has been, which is good. And there's not a lot of blood in it, which is great. Oh, the attack on the couple happened around 7 p.m. I've pretty much put everything that I can into the episode. I'll be honest, it's quite vague. The information that out there is vague. And quite often with the press, they've picked up certain details and they ran with it and they've changed things and they've gone, well, this is that, so therefore that must mean that, and quite often it isn't. So I've kind of put in what's a near approximation, but there's a lot of details that we just don't know. Detective Superintendent Ronald Hemmings said, it was a horrible inquiry. It never ceases to amaze me what a human being can do to another. sometimes over something quite trivial. It is pure evil. Wheeler was greedy for money and greedy for lust. But it's interesting that with this, having committed the murder, you would think that that would be the revenge thing. If he really hated the elderly couple and he wanted to kill them, and that was the revenge. But then he goes on to abduct and rape these young girls over a prolonged period as well. Over I think it's 2 hours, then another hour. So, you know, there's the maths, 3 hours. So that's roughly 5 hours of murder and torture and rape within an evening. I mean, he could probably say that he was drunk, but it's just utterly baffling. It really is. Yeah, I've told you about Milton's house. Yeah, see, it just doesn't make sense for me, sense for it to be him taking them to his house, then to the flat, then to the other flat. Although in the brief reference to the court documents, the judge does make reference to three flats, but he doesn't say what happens in the three flats. Maybe he invited the girls back to his first flat for fish and chips and they got on well, and then he invited them back to the other flat and said, oh, do you know, come and visit my mate, we'll watch some films, it'll be good fun, we'll have a nice evening. Maybe it was that. So maybe the first place they visited was fine and okay. We just don't know. What have we got? Most things I've kind of put in the episode. Police searching for the weapon during the day. Police search drains and sewers around Benson Close and Cromwell Road looking for a weapon. Described as a sharp object. Obviously, this was the Stanley knife. The attack was said to be vicious, but the police would not confirm if any of the victims had been dismembered. The lady herself had... it was pretty close. It was down to the bone. He would never really make much in terms of confessions on this, as with a lot of people. He kind of excused himself slightly through it, but he never really sat down and said, this is what I did. Except when he was in prison, well, this is what he said. He went to prison and he kind of confessed to... Not really confessing. I hate when people say that he confessed to his cellmate. It's not really confessing, is it? It's bragging. Let's just be honest about it. Confessing is bursting into tears and saying, I'm sorry, this is what I did. Turning around to your cellmate and going, I murdered two people and then I raped two girls as well. That's bragging. Or, let's call it as it is, being a bit of a tit. His mother's thoughts, I think this is... sorry. Hopefully by the time I do this next episode, I won't be bloody coughing anymore. Or snotty. Or injured. I'd love to not be buying two big rolls of kitchen towel every day. His mother said, I knew he was no angel, but when I found out what he had done, I couldn't believe it. I'm not condoning what Milton did. They are saying he is a psychopath, and he probably is, just like his father. But there is a caring side to him. He was held in a psychiatric prison. I think, as mentioned, I think it was Ashfield, the one over in Merseyside. He was held there, and he was assessed there before the trial. His mum said, we asked him why he did it, and he says he remembers nothing at all. And that's interesting. That's kind of what his dad says as well. So it could be that he's mimicking his dad because that's all he knows. It could be some kind of hereditary, some kind of hereditary mental disease. Could be. We just don't know what it is. So this is one of those episodes that is gonna hang there. And people can go, oh my, what really happened? We just don't know, people. People are weird, aren't they? So, Let me do the answer to the questions, and then I'm probably going to collapse. Question number one. How tall is the high-rise block on Benson Close? It's 11 stories high. Question number two. What is Milton's middle name? It was Duncan. Question number three. Milton was born in what maternity home? Oh, I just popped my ears again. It's called Rough Lee in Accrington. Question number four. What town did he grow up in? It's called Oswald Twizzle, which is Oswald Twistle. Oswald Twizzle. Question number five. What job did Milton's father do? He was a coalman. Question number six. Age 17, Milton's brother Ian was convicted... Milton's brother Ian was convicted of what three offences? The theft of a girdle. The theft of... come on, throat. The theft of a girdle. The theft of a brassiere. And the indecent assault of females. See, you can see this, the sexual element in there as well. Between these... brother and Ian, like, he's stole a girdle and a brassiere, and Milton wanted the girl who he attempted to rape to get into a swimsuit. All very weird. Question number seven. What was the name of Milton's stepfather? It was Paul Wheeler. Question number eight. What happened to Mr. and Mrs. Ambassador's flat 4 months before the murder? Well, I think I gave that one for you free, didn't I? There was a break-in. They were tied up, but nothing was stolen. And question number nine, what job did Milton do? He was a packer at a local freight company. So there we go, folks. Oh, fed up with coughing. Bored of it. So that's it, folks. Hope you have a good week. Stay safe and healthy, and etc., etc., etc. That's me done. Lots of love, everyone. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.